everybody. It's me, Laura Eady, and I am back with my podcast, The Notes Between, proudly sponsored by the wonderful Women in Jazz Media platform. And today's special guest is none other than Sarah Gillespie, who, of course, many of you know in the UK is a wonderful, critically acclaimed singer-songwriter slash mentor slash founder of Create Now Academy and many, 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 many other hats she proudly wears, which we'll discuss later on in the podcast. So first of all, hello, Sarah.
Hello, hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I cannot wait to delve in and talk to you. You are a remarkable, remarkable person, because not only have you done so much in the fields of music, you've managed to really carry with you everything you've learned along the way. And that means your love and passion for literature. That means your love and passion for mentorship. So you're not only a recording artist, but you've managed to really sort of set a huge milestone for younger women, which we'll discuss later on. But first and foremost, I just want to start you off, folks, with a quote, because I think this talks about Sarah in such a wonderful way, because we are going to talk about her music. And Mojo, and I quote, described you as a beat poet adventurer who strays beyond the realm of singer-songwriter. So what does that mean for you?
I think it's, you know, a line that just refers to, as you said, my love of poetry and literature. And when I was a kid and I was really into jazz and blues and Dylan, and I was trying to retrack the steps of that these cultural movements, and it landed me in the beat poetry movement, where poetry was created according to the musicality of the words rather than their dictionary definition, and usually in a complete improvised flow. And that is really my home when it comes to lyrics.
Exactly. And talk to us a little bit about that. What's your experience been with finding your own voice, as you said, as a lyricist first?
Well, I started writing songs when I was very, very young. Mm-hmm. And really young. In fact, I thought it was a naughty thing to do. And I hid it from my parents. Okay. So I was just writing songs on my piano. And then I was listening to music. I was very lonely. I was a very nerdy kid. Mm-hmm. I used to go to the library and listen to old, like, Robert Johnson and Bessie Smith records when I was about 13, mm-hmm. on my own on a Saturday. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I was really into a lot of poetry and reading plays and poems and books. And it just kind of percolated in me and popped out in my songs. So by the time I was about, I was busking around America for a whole year when I was 18 years old, and I was writing a lot of songs then. And I'd say that's when my songs started coming out with very impressionistic, rhythmic lyrics.
This is exactly what I wanted you to talk about, because folks listening, to talk about, and I don't know if you agree with this, Sarah, but to talk about one's own journey sometimes can be a bit daunting, you know, but you obviously know who you are as a person, an artist, and the way you've managed to sort of very, very quickly document your own journey. And that's, I think it's very much indicative of who your influences were. So you mentioned going to America, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, it does, we have spoken about this in person, over Zoom rather, mm-hmm. when you spoke about traveling from Norfolk to Minnesota. Mm-hmm. That's quite a big journey. And at 18, you said to be busking in America. That takes courage, and that's very much, I don't know if this was intentional, it feels like you were following the path of one of your very big influences, which I hear a lot in your music. You were kind of following in the footsteps of Dylan when he left home. And mm-hmm. it feels to me that you knew that you wanted to be a singer-songwriter, but you needed to be in a place where you felt seen and heard. I don't know if that resonates with you at all.
Yeah, I mean, I am half American. I'm American and British, and every summer spent in Minnesota. Well, my mother is from Dylan's home state of Minnesota, and when you're in Minnesota, it's kind of like being in Liverpool with the Beatles, you know. So there's that aspect culturally, but and then by the time I was 18, I was hungry to travel, and I just around America. I wanted to be inside the poems that I loved. I wanted to be inside the songs that I'd been listening to for years with such ferocity. I nearly, if I could have, I would have left home at 16 and done that. And when I finished my school, I worked in a pea factory for 6 months and saved every penny so that as soon as I could, when I was 18 years old, that October, and you and I are both December, I was 18 and a half. As soon as I could, my best friend and I got on an aeroplane and went, and we kind of went clockwise around the United States. And I couldn't wait to get to New York and go to the West Village, and I couldn't wait to do an open mic in the East Village and just play my guitar and busk on the streets of New Orleans and live in my first apartment and read. I was saturated in everything I loved, you know.
This is so inspiring. So you lived, in other words, and wow, what a remarkable, and that's only in your first 18 years of life per se. You lived the dream of many of us. You were honest enough with yourself to say, okay, I'm hungry for meaning. I'm hungry for life. I'm hungry for love. Therefore, what's the best medium? Music. And you went and you traveled and you made it happen. I wonder, did you feel that the bulk of your material for your first album, did it come around that time when you were traveling or over several trips?
Well, my music pops out all over the place, not just on Greyhound buses in America, you know. It can be one of my songs popped out almost completely in a cost cutter in Brockley in Southeast London. A song about anyway, so the songs are not obedient with me. They come when they want. But I wrote a lot of songs. Then I wrote songs afterwards. It was also, I wasn't ambitious to be a singer-songwriter at that point necessarily. I was writing songs, but I had nothing in my head about making money or a career out of it. I was too obsessed with, you know, as Tom Waits says, look, searching for the heart of Saturday night. You know, that was my thing. I wanted to like get to the nexus of the neon lights and the highways and fall in love and just travel and there'd be no end to it. I didn't want it to be a year out of education or anything. I knew it was my life. That was my life now. Although I did all those things, I didn't I didn't have a career plan or even an ambition really at that point.
Wow, remarkable. And so, again, well, I would say, even though you say very clearly now that you didn't want necessarily, it wasn't your priority or goal to, make it then as a singer-songwriter, what you did do was live your life through basically embodying your artistry. And that's, I feel like that's when it really started to pick up for you. And obviously, you've had an amazing career, a lot of it, which I will mention sporadically. But of course, folks, I will leave her website at the end of this podcast. So you can go ahead and, be mesmerized by everything Sarah has done. And you mentioned writing quite a bit, which I definitely can resonate with having done something similar to you. Not brave enough to leave home at 18. I did that at 24. But I did. And we've spoken about this, and a lot of people that attend your workshops, which we'll discuss later, have seen this. You do have the power of the written word, and you studied literature first and foremost. So how did that, what, can you talk to us a little bit about the trajectory from, delving yourself in literature in terms of academia and how it led to you finally becoming a singer-songwriter?
Yeah, it was a long struggle and it took a long time because after traveling around the USA for a year, I did take up my place at University of London to do a degree and I hated every second of it. And I refused to study literature and I refused to study poetry and I refused to study theatre because I was burning up with love for it so much, I didn't want to analyze it at the time. I didn't want to deconstruct it or find a fixed meaning. It was almost against my religion, as it were. That's how strongly I felt. I would not engage with any kind of pinning down of interpretation or even agreeing that there is such a thing. And so I only lasted for one term, and I dropped out of university and went straight back to Key West, Florida with my friends, and then went to live in New York City for a while. And then, after waiting tables in Greenwich Village for a long time and coming back to England and bouncing around, I kind of gave up after a while, thinking, I really don't want to work like this.
Yeah,
I want to use my mind and get ahead. And then I went back to university when I was in my mid-20s. And I studied literature and film as an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And I loved it at that point. I loved it. And I just loved reading and reading things that I wouldn't come across on my own volition, you know?
Stuff
that would not have organically come up in my pathway. And after that, I did a master's degree in politics and philosophy. And my real motive was trying not to go to work. I did not want to go to work. I did not want to wear a lanyard with my name on it. And I couldn't figure out how to do that. So being an academic in my head was a was a way of avoiding being in an office and pretending to be a good team player.
I get that. I totally get that.
I was trying to find an exit from that narrative, you know. That's what. And meanwhile, I was doing gigs in London, and I had a lot of big record labels courting me and coming to my shows, and I'd met countless music industry men telling me they were going to make me a star, and I nearly had a record deal in New York, and back and forward, and this went on and on and on and on. And finally, I was like, you know what? I'm just going to make one album just to get it off my chest, and then I'll go do a PhD.
Wow.
And I did it with that kind of attitude. Like, I just wanted to get it out of my body, as it were. I wanted to really get it down. And I'd recorded demos, but I wanted it to be a proper album. And so I went and recorded that. And that, I was astonished when it came out. And I remember being in Oxford to play the Oxford Jazz Festival. And I am a singer-songwriter, but I've always loved playing with jazz musicians.
Yeah.
Playing that festival, and I remember getting The Guardian delivered, like my friend met me for breakfast and she brought over The Guardian, and I was in there and I had 4-star review. And the next day, The Independent, I had 5 stars in The Independent, and then Radio 4 wanted me a Woman's Hour, and my press officer was doing such a great job. And after that, I ditched academia. Okay. And thought, right, now I want to be a singer-songwriter. So it was quite a long, it was a long trip.
Well, it sounds amazing. And and we're going to delve more into that, because what I'm hearing, aside from being very accomplished, rightly, deservedly so, what I'm hearing is a resilience, a very deeply rooted resilience to sticking to your authentic self, which is something that, you know, as songwriters, we, you know, it's a very tough industry to be a songwriter, especially when you're a singer-songwriter, because we both know that we wear multiple hats, which we'll explore. But very quickly, I wonder if you could just say the name of that first album that got you the 5-star Guardian.
Stalking Juliet.
Stalking Juliet. I mean, folks, Stalking Juliet. Songwriters, if you're listening, that's a name to remember. I'm always struggling with, like, what to call albums. So, therefore, go to Sarah. She'll sort you out. But I would love to play an oldie but goldie, as they say, from your album Wishbones, called Susanna Through a Helicopter. Very, very quickly, would you like to talk to us a little bit about that, what it means?
Yeah, it's actually a song that's got a specific story attached to it. It's about my daughter, Susanna. Mm-hmm. And being an introvert, I was in complete shock at the reality of having a baby and realizing, hang on a minute, they don't go to school till they're 5. That's 5 years of no solitude. So once I got her roped into the local nursery, I was very relieved that I could go home and write music or just be by myself, you know. And to my horror, they kept emailing me from the nursery and giving me updates about what she was doing and what she'd eaten and if she'd had an altercation with another 2-year-old or 3-year-old. And I had to write back and say, look, I really don't care. You've got me confused with her. I'm paying you to not look after her. I'm not interested in whether she had a wee or whether she just keep her there. And some of the emails they sent me were so banal that they made me laugh. And so I squidged them all together and made this song. Most of this song, that's why it's like it doesn't rhyme in a normal way. Most of it is little snippets of all her daily reports of what she was doing.
Okay, well, listen to the words. I did not know that. I knew it was about your daughter, but I had no idea about the process. As I said, this podcast explores, not only the lives and inspirations of songwriting, but practically the process. So that's a process that you can
That
really
one is,
say.
and I think so. I think, I'm kind of joking about it, but sometimes I think language can sound accidentally poetic, you know. And so in a lot of these emails, although they're sort of very sort of prosaic when they're by themselves, when they were together, they have a momentum. So, yeah.
That's great. Okay, folks, we're going to listen to Susanna through a helicopter dedicated to the nursery back then. No, I'm joking. All right, here we go, folks.
Susanna threw a helicopter at Callista Gilston's head. There was no blood, but Callista Gilston stole her backpack and bit her elbow. They were dancing minutes later to a song about the Black Death and stole Jamie Helston's biscuits while masquerading as the monster. Susanna rides a tractor with no hands and dances with the shadow of a spoon. Susanna found a football and appropriated it as a pillow. She rolled straight across into Christopher, who just established his own empire. And the Play-Doh fell across the border till law and order was reinstated by the Deep State Ofsted backup team, codename Muriel. Susanna says the butterflies will come when they know the secret knock for their cocoon. Susanna poured rice and glitter in a bottle to make a brand new shaker. She held a camera up to the window, said, I'm looking out for my papa. She dresses up as a dinosaur and a warrior Apache and runs into the garden, shouts out, you're never ever gonna catch me. Susanna says, butterflies will come could knock for the cocoon.
Brilliant. I have to confess, from listening to your music all day yesterday, Sarah, that one, for some reason or other, it stuck in my head the most. Not because, you know, the other songs weren't equally majestic, but because of how sincere it sounded. And now that I know the backstory, I think that that's one of the things I noticed in your beautiful process. How, you know how we talk about, you know, what comes first, music or lyrics? The music feels very bittersweet, but the lyrics are obviously nonsensical, as you say. So, but the two together just give this, you can interpret it in any way you can. And so I think it's remarkable how you have that, you know, and I totally get the reference to the Beat Poets about taking something that's just aggravating and silly, yet, you know, setting sort of inviting the listener to experience a very moody effect of the music, and vice versa, because the body of your work is just so, so diverse and rich and powerful. So it's, I just wanted to call that out because I thought that was brilliant as a technique. And it's not, you know, it's not true what they say that singer-songwriters, well, at least the artistic ones, the non-commercial ones, that we write very sad songs the whole time. We don't, you know, we just experience lyrics differently in stories. And having said that, because you wear many, many hats, aside from being, you know, an award-winning singer-songwriter, you are a brilliant mentor for women, for female singer-songwriters, and you've established a wonderful academy called Create Now. So I want to know what's that about for people who, let's say, want to join you on that journey? What is that? Just, yeah, talk to us about it.
So when I was touring my second album, In the Current Climate, I started getting asked by some of the venues if I would do a songwriting workshop. Mm. And I agreed very much, very quickly, because I wanted the financial boost. And so I was like, yeah, I'll do that. And then I got very excited about the idea of galvanizing everybody to write songs. And then I realized I had absolutely no idea how to write a song. I'd never thought about how to write a song. And I didn't have a process. And I didn't know what the hell I was going to say to all these people in my workshop. I remember being in a hotel in Bristol and Googling how to write a song. even though I was then, you know, I'd written hundreds of songs. And what I came across online really fascinated me, because at the time, and that was a while ago, there was just a surplus of, you know, just middle-aged white men telling you that you've got to get to the chorus in under a minute and have a very clear takeaway. And if you want to get into the A&R guys' ears, then you need to do X, Y, and Z. Very formulaic. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, you know what? I don't think the songwriters that I love think that way at all. In fact, I know they don't. Mm-hmm. I know that Dylan and Tom Waits and Joni Mitchell and people like that are definitely not constructing their songs under that paradigm at all. And I went and researched, and I also asked myself, really, how do songs come to me? Mm-hmm. And I started really enjoying teaching songwriting from that point onward, which is a completely different way of galvanizing music. And I, during the lockdown, I started doing songwriting workshops online. Mm-hmm. And they were for women specifically. They were for everybody, and I have men come to them, and that, you know, and everything. But what happened was more and more women were attracted to my work. And because it's kind of like creativity and music and philosophy and mindset, as well as songwriting. And what I noticed was that there are very, very many talented women out there who really, really wanted to write songs, or really wanted to finish a body of work. You know, they might have a few sketches of things, but they were not doing it. They couldn't quite get it out of them. And there's lots of different reasons for that, I've come to understand. But I started to get on a mission about it, because when I thought, well, this is my anecdotal experience. What are the hard facts? What's the data?
Yeah.
And when I started checking that out, I was astonished, because I'd never thought about being a woman in music or anything like that. I was not coming at it from the point of it being my identity or anything like that.
It was
merely that this work happened organically, and so many women were coming to me, and I was thinking, what the hell's stopping them from putting their music out? I don't get it. Like, what is stopping them? This is, in the West, is supposed to be, it's obviously not a meritocracy, but we like to imagine it is. And what is it that's hindering women from writing their songs? And sure enough, you know, the PRS figures that I found at the time, which was about 3 years ago, it was 82.7% of members are men. So 12% of composers and songwriters being paid for their work professionally in the UK are women. There's a big discrepancy. Wow. More generally, if you look at the pop world, women are just not writing songs. I mean, you have these huge figures like Billie Eilish or Adele or Beyonce, you know, these very, very visual big stars, but that is very unrepresentative of what's going on.
I agree.
And the other issue that came up a lot with when I started mentoring was I don't really agree with the idea of writer's block. I think it's more of a fear of writing crap, which is a line that Kay Tempest, the writer and poet, says. She doesn't believe in writer's block. She just thinks it's fear of writing shit. And what I noticed with women writing songs is we are so attached to the idea of being nice and romantic and spiritual, to such a degree that sometimes we cut off the other bits of ourselves that are not considered palatable for a woman.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm just like nodding here, folks, because everything, sorry to interrupt you, Sarah, but it just needs to be, it needs to be really appreciated what you're saying, that not many women have the courage to say that we need to embrace every single part of ourselves. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
And I think this is very crucial when you want to be an artist, or you just are an artist, because often what happens is we get this creative frustration. A lot of women come to me really quite, some of them quite depressed, because they really want to get something out, and it's not going away. You know, it's not going anywhere. It's knocking on the door of their brain relentlessly, but they can't get it out. And it's fear of humiliation, fear of risk, fear of visibility, or pragmatic concerns, so many things. But ultimately, I think that we censor ourselves. We censor the emotional palette with which we are drawing from. Songwriters like Tom Waits, for example, just take him as an example. You know, his songs are extremely funny. They're extremely dark. You know, these writers are drawing from their carnal energy, their intellect, their humor, their anger, their rage, their wit. And women tend to cut a lot of that out and just leave the kind of vulnerability and the romance and the you hurt me bit.
And that's a perfect, perfect segue into your single that's out now from your beautiful album Half Cut, out in February, the album that is, and it's called Molly of the Salt Sea. Have a listen, folks.
Johnny was a frugal man with 2 acres of derelict land. He could count, but he didn't know his ass from his elbow. Then one day he spied his love necking whiskey in the dark and dark. He was lost and mesmerized by the turquoise reef of the oyster eyes.
Molly of the Salt Sea. And we were talking about this before we started the podcast, the play on words, you know, salt of the earth. But Sarah very rightly corrected me when I said Molly of the sea salt or something. I said something like sea salt. And obviously that wasn't the title because, you know, brilliant. And just to carry on from our conversation, and I can't believe we're nearing the end of the podcast now. I could stay hours and hours talking to you, Sarah. I think that because you've asserted yourself as an artist and mentor, a lot of women, and I know most of them, really look up to you for that sense of guidance, but also a sense of, you know, confirming their talent. And because, you know, I think whether you're a man or a woman, I will go out on a limb here and say that we all need recognition, right? Of course, we're in music. I mean, if it's one thing if you want to play music to the four corners of your room and be happy about it, but, you know, I don't know many musicians that are like that. So, but the thing is, like you said very correctly, so unfortunately for women, it's a lot harder for many, 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 many reasons. And like you said, and thank you for being honest about it, you didn't really, or it didn't really, it didn't dominate your process of thought by thinking, well, why can't women just do it? What's the issue? And once you realized, as you said yourself, that it's actually a lot harder for women, you created this beautiful platform. And more so, you created this record label. You co-founded Pastiche Records, which, you know, I'm a part of, and I joined later on, and I'm so grateful for that. And if you look at the roster of women featured on Pastiche Records, these are incredible women, not just because of what they've achieved, but really through your mentorship program and some not, they've managed to really redefine their sound. And I've listened to most of the music from these wonderful artists, and each track is very, you can tell that there's a process, there's an intent, but there's also a sense of freedom. And I think, like you said, there's no formula to making a hit record. You just have to make the record. And if we were, you know, if we were back in the 60s and we were, you know, traipsing around Woodstock with Jimi Hendrix and the Melanie Safka and all our favorite people, and then fast forward to, you know, I don't know, Oklahoma and Toronto, even in Canada with Joni Mitchell, maybe we wouldn't even be thinking about these things, how to write a hit record. I don't, like you said, and I agree with you, they didn't really think about it, but we've, fast forward to this day and time, we're so oversaturated with information that it's very hard for listeners, you know, never mind us, the creators, but it's very hard for listeners to discern good quality from bad quality. I mean, let's face it. So it's become a thing of having people like yourself sort of take the reins and say, okay, you want to write a song? Let's talk about it. Let's explore it. And so I think there needs to be more people like you, you know, and I thank you for it, because I think it's incredible the amount of work you do. And I can't believe we're nearing the end of the podcast, but I will like to ask you on that beautiful note, pun intended, what advice do you have for female singer-songwriters? And if there's like one or two bits of advice from the heart, what would it be?
First of all, I guess, to be emotionally brave when we're composing and try not to get caught up in who's going to like it or what the music is, which is another version of who's going to like it. Is it jazz? Is it pop? Is it folk? Is it this? Is it that? The terror of not being liked can be looked in the eye, and we can take action from a different place, which is, how do we want to live our one precious life? Do we want to live it in fear, or do we want to be bold?
Yeah.
So I think it's about putting the responsibility on ourselves, and then supporting each other. And also, once the body of work is out of us, to be strategic and clever in the way that we unleash it into the world as much as we can.
Yeah, that's really sound advice. And I think because I do want a little more time with you, I'm just going to ask a follow-up to that. That, besides it being very, very sound advice, and like you said, from the heart, to focus on the music, focus on being brave. And do you reckon, because of the market we find ourselves in, that there is a way for female, in particular, female singer-songwriters to actually sustain their career financially?
Absolutely, I do. I also believe that it's far more likely to happen when we lean into our zone of genius and our real, the crème de la crème of ourselves. You know, that bit of us that is the curly-brained strangeness of ourselves, and not trying to please everybody. Then, if we can run with that and we can take it very seriously and back it up like a parent, you know, go right, you're going to go out there into the world, I'm going to back you up, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. Then, with be forceful in the way that we decide to take action. Then, I believe, yes, you can make a great career and a living. Obviously, I'm reluctant to make a blanket statement about that because I know that everybody has their own situations, their own circumstances, and various privileges and shortcomings and all sorts of different realities. But if we live in the West, as women, we have some agency. We don't have complete agency, and we don't have none. We have some. And that's quite an annoying amount because it's difficult to manage it. And I think it's about galvanizing that and being very clear and very decisive with what we do.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm so happy to hear you say those words. Not many people do. Not many people say, if you want something, go for it. And I would say it reminds me of a beautiful collection of letters, actually, from Anna Maria Rilke, Letters to a Young Poet. And this is to end on a funny note. Of course, where do we know that book from? If you haven't read the book yourself, you know it from Sister Act, the film with Whoopi Goldberg. And I think you know the scene where Whoopi Goldberg, and I think it's Sister Act 2, right? Where she turns around to this incredible singer who is, as we both know, Lauryn Hill from the Fugees,
Oh,
another
great.
singer-songwriter genius. And she turns around and she says to I forgot what her name was, the character in the film. So she turns to Lauryn Hill and she says, "Have you read this book by Anna Maria Rilke?" And she goes, "No." And she goes, "Well, basically, the gist of it is that if you wake up in the morning, and this is the book itself, and there's nothing that you can think of other than writing, go be a writer." So with that same token, this is what you're saying, that if there's you wake up Right? If you wake up in the morning and with a song in your heart or an insane need to just bash out a rhythm or anything musical, and you cannot stop, then go and be in music, you know? So I think that's what it reminded me of.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, when we have that drive to create something, it's really like our talent lobbying our brain on behalf of itself, going, please, please let me out. Please let me out. Please let me out.
Yes. Oh gosh, Sarah, it's been a dream hosting you. Thank you so much for joining this podcast.
Thank you for having me and playing my music.
Of course. And just very quickly, while we play the last track that we're going to hear today, on my show at least, Gloria, from your upcoming record released in February 2024, titled Half Cut, just remind folks, when is your show, your album launch?
My album launch in London is the 1st of February. I can't remember if it's Thursday or Friday. At Pizza Express Jazz Club on Dean Street. And then we are playing some shows in the UK and the United States. And we're currently booking more in at the moment. So
Amazing.
it'll be on the website.
Fantastic. And your website is, for folks that want to listen,
SarahGillespie.com, Sarah with an H.
Sarah with an H, and Gillespie from Dizzy Gillespie.
And the academy is createnowacademy.com.
Great, folks. So you heard what she said. Listen to the lady and be inspired by Sarah Gillespie. This has been such a treat. Thank you for listening. This has been the podcast called The Notes Between, hosted by yours truly, exploring everything in the world of songwriting and beyond, hosted by Women in Jazz Media. Thanks for listening.
Angel, it goes to show we're not always reaping what we sow. When you lose it, you find me spending all the money you saved in a coastal arcade. And you're bailing me out from the darkness now. The archangel holy morning, morning truce. And the geese flying from Belarus.
Fly on to Belarus.